We have already talked a little bit about inspiration, that God's incredible book claims to be inspired. We've talked a little bit, and that's all we're going to talk about anything is a little bit about ancient texts, and we've talked a little bit about archaeology, which is really where we are today. The story of the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, was a story that involved a little bit of archaeology. We will be later on talking about science and prophecy, but we are going to have several days, a few days, where our time deals with things related to archaeology in one way or another. We talked on Monday about Greek texts, and we had a little bit more of that on Tuesday, but Tuesday we mostly talked about Hebrew texts of the Bible, especially the Masoretic text and the Dead Sea Scrolls. We haven't had very much about inscriptions, and I'm going to hedge on that by throwing inscriptions today in with other testimony. There are a lot of inscriptions, no, excuse me, there are a few inscriptions from very ancient times in Bible lands that are very helpful in understanding some things about the scriptures and in identifying characters in the Bible that we are not going to talk about. Some stones that have engravings of names and battles and things like that. A lot of things from Nineveh, which we'll talk about briefly on another day, that do corroborate biblical stories, demonstrate the biblical stories are true and accurate. But what we're going to talk about today is going to be some inscriptions of a much smaller order. Up on the wall right now, there is a picture of an excavation in the land of Israel, in fact, very close to the city of Jerusalem. It's an excavation that was started in 1979 under the direction of an archaeologist named Gabriel Barkai. It's just on the south side of Jerusalem. It's on the shoulder of the hill above the valley of Ben-Hinnom, or Gehenna, as that place is referred to in the New Testament. This particular portion of the excavation is what used to be a cave, but perhaps you can tell, if you can see the picture well enough, you can tell that it isn't a cave anymore because it doesn't have a roof on it. When this excavation was started, the first thing that they found in this place, in this area right here, was some guns, and some ammunition and various things that belong to the Turkish army. You see, what we have here is an opening here that's the main chamber of what used to be a burial cave. This was at one time a burial cave used by some Jews. And in the 19th century, this burial cave was converted to an arsenal by the Turkish army that was occupying Israel in those days as a part of the Ottoman Empire. And they had an explosion, there was a battle there, they had an explosion there, and there was debris and things left behind, including weapons and various things relating to that. But as the archaeologists from 1979 through 1989 dug this area and quite a large surrounding area, a small excavation, but still a good-sized area, they went through a lot of layers of the history of what has gone on in Jerusalem from the 19th century and on. In fact, they started out by digging up a road that was a 20th century road. So from the 20th century and on backward, they had a lot of things relating to the various periods of occupation in Jerusalem. As they worked their way down to bedrock level, where this cave, one of seven burial caves that was in that vicinity that they did excavate, where this cave was located. This cave was originally dug out as a burial chamber in the 7th century B.C., in the time of King Josiah in the 7th century B.C. For the use of a well-to-do Jewish family that lived in Jerusalem. The site was later quarried. The stones that had originally formed the walls and roof of the cave were largely cut away in the Middle Ages and turned into a church building that was there close to this site. And then later, when the Turks had control of it, they took those same quarried stones that had been a part of the church building, that had been a part of the burial cave, and turned them into some official buildings for use of their people. And so it goes. Things are used and reused and reused again there in the lands of the Bible, which is one of the things that sometimes makes it a little hard to sort things out and figure out what goes where, which is more the topic that I'll be talking about on Monday when it comes to really sorting out the archaeology and the kinds of things that turn up. Well, this particular site, when they were digging out, before I get into very many details about that, again, this was in Jerusalem, it was in 1979. Originally, it was a cave tomb dug into the rock. The dating of it places it in the 7th and 6th centuries BC, in the days of Jeremiah, of Josiah, and of the kings who succeeded Josiah, his three sons and grandson that sat on the throne after him. The previous picture may not have been real clear about how that burial cave would have been used. This one might give you a little bit more of an idea, as it has some student volunteers occupying the places of honor where bodies would have been laid in this tomb originally. You have the area down here that's the floor area, and then you have three shelves or benches that are carved out around that floor area. And it was designed so that you could have 9 bodies laid out in there at the same time. 9 people at the same time occupying those burial benches in this cave. You only see 8 people there, I think. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Because this fellow over here, Mr. Barkai said, wanted to be alone. He didn't want anybody laying next to him. And so the one over on this side is unoccupied because he didn't want anybody laying by him. But it was designed for 8 people, nine people. And on this shelf here, you probably would have had the patriarch of the family, the one for whom the tomb was originally dug. When we read in the scriptures about the burial practices of the Israelites, of the Hebrews, we find that the descriptive language they use fits right in with the kind of scene that we see here. Because when Abraham dies in Genesis chapter 25 and verses 8 through 10, when Abraham dies and is buried, he is buried where? The cave of Machpelah. And who was already there? Sarah, his wife. And it says of Abraham that he was gathered to his people. He died, he was buried with his wife, he was gathered to his people. And that expression is used many times in the Bible to refer to the burial practices that were associated with entombing these people who had died. They were gathered to their people. In fact, that expression has at least a threefold meaning. There are various kinds of meaning that we can attribute to that expression, gathered to his people or gathered to his fathers. We find that the same thing happens in the story of Isaac. When Isaac dies, he also is gathered to his people. We find this is what it says about Jacob in Genesis 49 and verse 29, I think it is, that Jacob was gathered to his people. We find this is what it says of the whole generation that came into the land of Canaan with Joshua in Judges chapter 2, verse 10. That generation passed away, and they were gathered to their fathers or gathered to their people. Now, one of the reasons that that expression fits is because in Judea, in Israel, and in the surrounding culture for that matter, it was typical practice to have a common burial area like this, where a tomb would be used for many individuals and, in fact, many generations of the same family. And that's one of the reasons that gathered to their people made a lot of sense. Another reason is because, by and large, they did believe in an afterlife. When Abraham died, he was gathered as a spirit. He was gathered to his people, and there was that connotation in the expression. But there is another connotation in that expression that I want to call to your attention right now. And that is the fact that even though we have benches here that would comfortably accommodate 9 bodies without any undue crowding or complaining on their part, this burial cave was really intended for more than 9 people. Because the way this would work is that you would lay out the patriarch in there, and you might leave him undisturbed as a token of your respect for him. And you might even possibly lay out the matriarch, the wife of the patriarch, or maybe the 2 wives, since there's 2 spots over there, I don't know. I don't really know for sure just how that would have been worked. But by and large, these places were intended to be occupied on a temporary basis. And after the person's bones have been exposed by the total deterioration of their flesh, it was common practice to gather those bones together and to redeposit them in another place. Now, in later centuries, in the first century, in the time of Jesus, they weren't making burial caves as big and elaborate as this for the most part, but they still were following the same general custom. And that's why I've seen pictures at least of an ossuary being a box, sometimes made of stone, sometimes made of something else, in which bones were deposited. And there was a recent find in Israel where a tomb was uncovered by a bulldozer that was doing some routine kind of work, of a tomb that belonged to the priestly family that had the surname Caiaphas, the name that we see in the New Testament associated with the man who pronounced the death sentence against Christ as far as the Jews were concerned. Caiaphas, the son-in-law of Annas, the high priest. And there was an ossuary in that tomb which had the bones in it according to the writing on the bone box, had the bones in it, of Joseph Caiaphas, who apparently, from the high priest list that still exists from those times, probably was the high priest that held the trial in which Jesus was condemned among the Jews. And there are in that box the bones of a man who would be probably about 60 years old, as well as the bones of two or three other people. I don't remember. It's not that they don't know how many others are in there. It's just that I don't remember with certainty whether it was two or three other individuals that were also in that box, along with the bones of that middle-aged or senior citizen male who was buried there, who was probably the high priest that we read about in the New Testament. Well, in this time, generally speaking, around Jerusalem, they weren't using a box for the bones. Instead of that, they had a separate room in the tomb in which the bones would be placed when they gathered the bones together in order to free up space on the bench there so that they could put a fresh body in place. When the flesh had deteriorated and they needed to do a little house cleaning, they would gather the bones and any relics that might be left, things like rings or jewelry or gold teeth or whatever it might be, they would gather those things together and they would place them into a repository. And this tomb, which Dr. Barkai excavated in 1979, had such a repository under this bench. It was a deeper room underneath this bench. And so, as he was engaged in this process of excavation, he had very little expectation of finding very much of importance. Because what happens to tombs over a period of 2,500 years, more or less, what happens to tombs? Grave robbers, okay? Today, we give grave robbers a PhD and call them archaeologists, but in ancient times, they were thought of as thieves. Grave robbers like to get in here and see what kind of valuables they can recover and make a profit on. And so, in looking around this, as well as the other tombs that were in this immediate vicinity that they excavated, they had no real expectation of finding much of anything except for the occasional scrap that had maybe been overlooked. And they had found a couple of gold earrings that had been overlooked by those who had come before. Well, Dr. Barkai says that at this particular time in this excavation, all the graduate students and most of the other professionals were off doing other things. And what he had at this site was a class group of about sixth grade students, a bunch of 12 and 13 year old kids. And one of those boys was really a nuisance to him because he was such a pest. He was constantly, as Dr. Barkai put it, asking him silly questions and constantly pestering him about things. And so he thought to himself when he saw the repository down underneath, he looked in there, and all he could see in there was rock. There was nothing but stones on the floor as he looked in there. And he thought, well, this is a good way to get rid of this pest. I'll send him in there to search that and to look around. And at least for a while, I won't have to worry about this guy. And so he sent this young fellow in there. And it wasn't 5 minutes later that the young fellow came out and came running up to Dr. Barkai with a little vase in his hand, a little clay pot, which is totally against the rules of archaeology. You don't ever move something until you have made a very careful record of exactly where and how it was discovered. But he came running out and he had this clay pot in his hand, which was very upsetting to Dr. Barkai, but also was an eye-opening revelation that maybe there's something here that he did not anticipate. And so he personally inspected the place underneath himself and began to do an earnest excavation of the repository underneath that burial bench, began to do an excavation that called for professional assistance and trained assistance and sent all the children home. The kids found it, but they didn't get to experience the excitement of what was left in there. Among the things that were found in this repository, because you see the stones were actually not stones of the floor, they were actually stones of the ceiling. The ceiling had dropped a layer over the years, and whoever the first grave robbers were that looked in there, they drew the same conclusion that Dr. Barkai drew. That is, everything's already gone. And so they didn't bother to go in and mess around in the rubble, and they missed what was there. And there was a lot there. There were oil lamps in there. There were beads in there, lots and lots of beads, beads made of various kinds of stones as well as precious metals. There was jewelry in there, very fine, intricate, lovely jewelry, earrings, jewelry with moving pieces, some very beautiful artwork and so forth. And the jewelry and beads attributed to a total of something like 120 silver objects that came out of this repository, as well as several gold objects. And there were hundreds of clay bottles and juglets and lamps. And when I say clay bottles, I'm not talking about big clay jars. I'm talking about little ones, like what you would put perfume and ointments and things like that in, all kinds of delicate work and lovely things that were originally buried with the people who were placed in this tomb back in the days of Josiah and Jeremiah, back in the 7th century B.C. Also, I don't have it on this list that I'm putting up here on the screen, but another thing that was found in this tomb was about 40 arrowheads, and several of them bent. Supposition is that those arrowheads may have been in the bodies of several of the people that were put in there. Because this tomb was in use at the time when Nebuchadnezzar's army came up against the city of Jerusalem. And so it may very well be that some of the casualties in that battle with Nebuchadnezzar may have been entombed in this place along with the family members, or maybe some of the family members were casualties in the battles with Nebuchadnezzar that took place in the early part of the 6th century B.C. But along with all of these objects that were found were two small corroded silver objects. And one of those is pictured for you on the screen. But as you look at that, you don't get any sense of size, and that's one of the reasons that you have two Tootsie Rolls today, or at least I hope you have two Tootsie Rolls today. I invite you right now to take out one of those two Tootsie Rolls and unroll it and just look at it. Because that Tootsie Roll is just about the size of the silver object, the corroded silver object that is pictured on the screen for you. It was just about identical in size to that. Now, in the process of time, they found not one, but two of these, and the second one they found was about half the size of the first. The first one they found in place. When the young woman who was working saw it, she realized it probably was something very unusual and very important, and she summoned the archaeologist, the overseer, Dr. Barkai, to come and see it and document it himself and take pictures of it and so forth. When they found the second one, it was a very different situation. It was found in the dirt that they had carried out. It was overlooked, completely missed, but in an excavation of this type, you sift every bucket full of dirt that goes through. And the second one, being much smaller than the first, had been completely overlooked, but they found it in the sifting of the dirt. And so they had these two small silver objects, one about the size of that Tootsie Roll you have, and the other one only about half the size of that. It was a small silver roll. It had a hole going right through the middle of it. It was probably worn on a string, and for that reason, Dr. Barkai initially identified it as an amulet, something that might have been worn for purposes of magic or something like that. A small silver roll, probably worn on a string, about 1¼ inches tall. And having that item in hand and doing something meaningful with it were two very, very different propositions. The goal of having a little roll of something made out of silver is to try and figure out, what is it? What is the purpose of this? Why was it rolled up like this? And so you want to unroll it. But it was very, very thin, very, very brittle with age, very, very fragile. And so the proposition of unrolling this thing was a very daunting undertaking. And Dr. Barkai turned it over to the professional staff at the Israel Museum to see what they could do with it. And it took them 3 years to do anything with it. In the meantime, they broke off a few small pieces off the corners and off the edges, trying to figure out how to get it unrolled successfully. Ultimately, they figured out that they could coat it with an acrylic, a stripe at a time, and slowly unroll it using the acrylic as a backing to hold the thing together. And by doing so, after 3 years, they unrolled this small silver roll. A small silver roll probably worn on a string, about 1⅛ inches tall, unrolled to a length of 3.8 inches, inscribed with Paleo-Hebrew script from the time of Jeremiah. I don't think you can see much about the script on that. If the picture was a whole lot larger and clearer, you still couldn't see very much about the script on that, because it is very fine and very lightly embedded in the silver. It was the work of a jeweler. There's really no doubt that it was the work of a jeweler. This fine work is so small that in order to read the letters, you've got to have a magnifying glass. I'd have to have more than a magnifying glass, but you've got to have a magnifying glass to read these letters. It's an interesting proposition to wonder, how did the fellow who did this do it? Because he didn't have a magnifying glass. Among the artifacts that came out of that tomb repository, there were some little glass jars. And what's remarkable about that is this is a good 500 years before glass blowing really was perfected as an art. The working of glass was not something that was that was well understood at this day and time. They did make glass objects, but those glass objects were tremendously valuable and tremendously expensive because they were so hard to produce. Glass was considered to be a very valuable commodity. At any rate, they did not have a magnifying glass to work on that with. What they probably did do was take something like a small straw, a little reed, something like that, and use that as a means of focusing on a very small area at one time. And by that means, taking a very fine tool to write on this little roll of silver while it was still not a roll, while it was laying out flat there. Now, what was it that they wrote on this little silver scroll before they rolled it up and hung it on a string? What they wrote on the little silver scrolls before they rolled them up and hung them on a string is, "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace." This is a picture of the smaller of the two scrolls, which actually was written in a more legible hand. It was easier to see the writing on the small one than it was on the big one, even though the writing itself was smaller, as the scroll was smaller. But what was found on these two scrolls was this passage from the book of Numbers. Now, there are a lot of reasons why that's really very important. For one thing, this is the first time in an archaeological dig they ever found the name Jehovah or Yahweh on anything in Jerusalem. The name of Jehovah is certainly known in many places in the land of Israel in inscriptions and otherwise, but it was the first time they ever found that in the city of Jerusalem. And that in itself made Gabriel Barkai and his associates extremely excited. He wrote an article for Biblical Archaeology Review magazine just when they read the first word and saw that it said Yahweh. "We have found the name of the Lord in Jerusalem." And they submitted an article to Biblical Archaeology Review in 1983 just based on that portion of what they understood when they unrolled the first larger scroll and were able to read that.
Now, when you say it was inscribed, now, is that like...
scratched into the metal.
Okay.
It is inscribed in the sense of being scratched into the metal. You should, if you're not too far away, be able to make out the old Hebrew letters that are scratched into the silver metal in this picture that's on the wall right now. Now, there were several things about this that were doubly exciting when they realized what it actually was, which is the priestly blessing or the priestly benediction that Moses commanded the priests to give for the people of Israel on a regular basis in Numbers chapter 6, verses 24 through 26. One of the reasons that that was very exciting is because, according to the critical textual analysis of the late 19th and early 20th century, the P tradition, the portion of the book of Numbers and Deuteronomy and Genesis and the whole Pentateuch, the whole five books of Moses, the portion of that which they believed would be ascribed to the priestly tradition, and this is a part of that priestly tradition in that line of analysis, should have been written in the Second Temple period, maybe in the 4th century B.C. And here we have this in use, well known among the people, among the Jews of Jerusalem, in the 7th century B.C. All right, the people know this scripture in the 7th century B.C. And it is not something that is unique and special because we don't have one, we have two of these scrolls where this blessing is being carried around in some way on the person of the individual who was buried there. You also connect this, or at least I also connect this, with an instruction that is given in Deuteronomy chapter 6 in verses 8 and 9. Deuteronomy 6 verses 8 and 9 is where we have been told now that we are to, well, let's turn and read it. I don't want to paraphrase it. Deuteronomy chapter 6. He says in verse 6, "These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates." What did the Lord tell the people to do? Wear what? Okay. These commandments, these ordinances, the things that the Lord your God has commanded you. Well, he commanded them to recite this priestly blessing. And so I see this as being an instance of carrying through on this idea. That the idea that they literally should wear the scriptures on their person is an idea that didn't die out. It's an idea that's still in practice among Jews today. This is an idea that Jesus addresses in Matthew 23 and 5 when he's speaking of the Pharisees and he says they make broad their phylacteries. Well, this wasn't a broad phylactery, it was pretty small. But it was also a precious metal. So it sounds like to me there was still an element of pride involved in the way this was done. But they make broad their phylacteries. A phylactery being a little box in which you would have a roll, a scroll, that had a portion of scripture written on it, and it would be folded up or rolled up preferably and placed in this box. And then you might dangle it from your wrist or from some place on your garments or hang it over your forehead. I don't know where these two little rolls were worn, but it seems to me that they were trying to carry through on this idea that was expressed in the book of Deuteronomy, that you should talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and lie down and when you get up, and tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads, write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. But I would ask you, do you think that this is what the Lord actually had in mind when he gave that instruction to Moses, that they should make a little thing of silver or paper or whatever else and dangle it around their wrist or dangle it between their eyes or whatever it might be? Ron?
Yes and no.
Yes and no. Explain that.
The no is the spiritual standpoint. I didn't want you to just carry it around with you, but the yes part of it is he needed this as posterity for us.
Okay, so the yes part is that there is a reminder. My mom does that, see. My mom types out little verses of scripture and then she sticks them on the bathroom mirror. And she sticks them in various places around her house as a constant reminder of what that verse has to say. And there is value in that. Until it becomes a ritual where you think that by the fulfillment of the ritual you have satisfied what God is talking about here. Because the first thing he says is, impress them on your heart. And that's the point. To think about these things until they become a part of your mind, wear them on your forehead, and a part of your actions, wear them on your hands, until they become an integral part of your life. Nevertheless, historically, we find here in the days of Jeremiah, as also in later times, that there was a tendency, at least, to treat that in a literal way. Now, before we go to the next thing, because we're about to abruptly change subjects, except we're still in the realm of other evidence, before we leave the silver scrolls behind, I invite you, if you want to go ahead and eat that Tootsie Roll that you have opened. You're not required to by any means, but if you want to, you may go ahead and eat that Tootsie Roll that you have opened. That's why you have two of them. If you don't want to, just hang on to it, because we're not done with the Tootsie Rolls yet. But you do have a second Tootsie Roll. And if you eat the Tootsie Roll, I want it to be in the spirit of what it says in Ezekiel chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. He said to me, Son of man, eat what is before you, eat this scroll, then go and speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he gave me the scroll to eat. Then he said to me, Son of man, eat this scroll I am giving you, and fill your stomach with it. So I ate it, and it tasted as sweet as honey in my mouth. And I want you to associate that idea that God wanted people to consume his word. He wanted them to in the days of Jeremiah. He wanted them to in the days of Moses. He wants us to do that today, to take his word into our lives, to consume it, and to find the taste to be as sweet as honey. I do hope that in this case it will not be like the passage in Revelation chapter 10, verse 9, where John was also told to take the scroll and eat it, and it says that it was in his mouth as sweet as honey, but it was bitter when it got to his stomach. And I hope that none of you have that reaction to the Tootsie Scroll that you have had today as a reminder of that particular artifact that attests to the antiquity, not only to the antiquity of the text in Numbers, but to the antiquity of the text in Deuteronomy, because of the custom that was being observed there by these people who lived in Jerusalem in the 7th century B.C. What we're going to move on to next is seals and bulla. Now, perhaps the first thing that comes to your mind with seals is marine mammals, but that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about those fur-bearing creatures that hang around the docks and wharves and so forth. We are talking about what? Okay? A stamp, something that you use to leave an impression on a soft material. What about this other word, bulla? And that's actually the plural. If we took off the E, we'd have one of them. But we're going to be talking about more than one of these. So what about that other word, bulla? Well, later on, when we take off the A and the E, this word does relate to the pronouncements that one like a pope or someone like that issues as an edict. But in fact, what this word means, well, I'm going to demonstrate what it means, or you're going to demonstrate what it means. I want you to unwrap your second Tootsie Roll if you ate your first one, or just take your first one in hand if you didn't eat your first one. But take a Tootsie Roll in hand anyway. And I want you to take that Tootsie Roll, and I want you to mash it, and then I want you to roll it into a ball, okay? Take that Tootsie Roll and mash it, and then roll it into a ball. It doesn't have to be a real fine ball, but roll it into a ball. Once you have that rolled into a ball, take the wrapper that it came out of and set it down on a firm surface. Your Bible's probably adequate, or your notebook, or a bench beside you. And take that little round ball of Tootsie Roll and set it in the middle of the wrapper and mash it flat with either your thumb or your finger. For purposes of illustration, you are looking at a bulla. Okay? A bulla is a lump of clay that has been impressed with a seal. In this case, the lump of clay was Tootsie Roll chocolate. And the seal that is impressed upon it is your finger or your thumb, whichever you use. Now, if you take that and give it a close look, I bet you can see the ridges of your fingerprint in it. Can you see the ridges of your fingerprint in it?
Yeah.
That would serve to identify you, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, these were intended to serve as a means of identification. We have the story of Judah and Tamar, which is a very unattractive, unsavory story, where Judah has invited Tamar to have sex with him, thinking that she is a prostitute, and he doesn't have any money to pay her. He doesn't have a lamb with him or a kid of the goats to pay at that time. And so he says, "What pledge should I give you?" And she says, "Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand." She figured if she had his seal, then everyone would know that he had been with her. And of course, later on, when this story plays out, that means of identification proves necessary for the saving of her life because of the steps she has taken to have a child here. But his seal was a means of identification. A seal was a symbol of authority. Jezebel wrote letters in Ahab's name, placed his seal on them, and sent them to the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city with him when she wanted that vineyard in Jezreel to try and make Ahab happy for a few minutes. She used his seal in order to invoke his authority. A seal was a legal signature. In the story of Jeremiah, where he bought the land from his cousin, when that transaction was accomplished, Jeremiah says, "I signed and sealed the deed, had it witnessed, and weighed out the silver on the scales." So a seal was used for a legal signature. The impression of the seal was on a lump of clay, a bulla. A seal was used for identification, and so it usually had its owner's name on it. Now, sometimes we think back to more recent history in the Middle Ages when sometimes seals might only have a picture on them because literacy was not at a premium. The seals of Old Testament times generally have words on them because literacy was more widespread and in more use then than it was in the Middle Ages of more modern times. Because a seal conveyed authority, it often had its owner's office inscribed on it. And because a seal was a legal signature, it tended to be used often on letters and other documents. And because of that, there are hundreds of bulla that have survived from ancient times in the land of Israel and around Jerusalem. Hundreds of these things have survived because they were used so often for so many different purposes. We're going to talk about just a couple of them here today. It was said in 1978, an archaeologist named Yigal Yadin said that out of all of the hundreds of seals and bulla that have been found in the Holy Land, not one has been found that could be identified with a person named in the Bible. Now, that doesn't mean that there were none found that had names that might be in the Bible, but there were none that could be confidently identified with an actual biblical character. That, however, has changed. It has changed really quite a lot in the years since 1978. There's a picture of a seal here, and one of the things that I want to call to your attention about this seal, partly because we were just talking about the silver scrolls being worn on a string, is that this seal had a hole that went all the way through it. This seal was carried on a string, just like the one that it said Judah had in the story of Judah and Tamar. He gave her the seal on its cord, on its string. This one was carried on a string. This particular seal has an inscription on it. And by the way, those Hebrew letters, that is old Hebrew writing, Paleo-Hebrew writing, but those letters are written backwards. They're mirror images of what they should be. Why do you suppose that is? So that when it leaves the impression will be right to the reader's eye. Okay? So it's engraved backwards. This particular seal is engraved with a message that says, belonging to Abdi, servant of Hoshea. Now, the name Abdi is the same as the Bible name Obadiah, but this particular Abdi is not known to us in the Bible. However, the man he served, Hoshea, was the last king of Israel who reigned in Israel from 732 to 722 BC, who lost his kingdom to the Assyrians when they invaded and overran Samaria at that time. One of the reasons I wanted to put this seal on the screen was to call your attention to the picture that's down here at the bottom. I hope that you can make out something of that. There is a picture here of a round ball. It has three rays going up and it has three rays going down, and then it has wings. Now, what do you suppose a round ball with rays and wings is a symbol of? What? How about that thing that goes across the sky? The sun. The sun. Okay. I call that to your attention because this particular, we're going to see it again in a couple of the other things that I'm going to be showing you. This particular symbol was in widespread use in the Middle East. It's on the Egyptians and the Phoenicians. It turns up all over the place. And that will be relevant to some further discussion that we'll have on another day. But here we have the sun disk, the wing sun disk, on this seal that belonged to Abdi, the servant of Hoshea, there in Israel. Here's another impression. This one is a bulla rather than a seal. This is the clay rather than the seal itself. And I think maybe I need to ask another question. I already said that lots and lots of these were made because they were used as signatures on letters and legal documents, and so there were lots and lots of these clay bulla that were impressed. But the fact that there were lots of them didn't necessarily mean that lots of them would survive into modern times. There's another factor here that's involved in the fact that a lot of these bulla, these little clay blobs, survived into modern times. And what do you suppose that factor would be? Fire. Okay, fire. Now, the documents these were attached to didn't survive into modern times. This was originally on a roll of papyrus. The papyrus is long gone, but the bulla remains. Why did the bulla remain? What did fire have to do with it? It's like a kiln. When you burn down a city, as Jerusalem was burned by Nebuchadnezzar, and the royal archives burn in that fire, all of the documents are destroyed. But rather than destroying the seals, the bulla that were on those documents, what the fire does is it hardens them into a ceramic material that will last a long, long time. And that's why we have a lot of these bulla that have turned up in recent years in excavation, as well as in previous years in excavations there in Judah and in Jerusalem especially. This particular seal is one that has an inscription that says, belonging to Ahaz, son of Jotham, king of Judah. Now, Ahaz ruled in the days of Isaiah. He was the predecessor to Hezekiah. And this is an impression of the in 2 Chronicles chapter 28. Now, those two seals were both interesting, or those that seal and that bulla, to get the terminology right. But these two are the ones that are actually the most interesting to me of all the ones that have been found and have been identified. The seal that is pictured on top there, and the seal that's pictured on the bottom, bulla, rather, the bulla pictured on top and the bulla pictured on the bottom, were both impressed with one and the same seal. They were both made with the same original imprint, the same original stamp. This one on top was a little bit off-center, and so it didn't go to the edges quite as well, and there are ridges here that are the ridges of a fingerprint. There is a fingerprint that still remains impressed on this bulla from the time when it was soft, wet clay, when it was placed on a papyrus roll, a document, and the impression of the papyrus remains on the back. You can see the grain of where the papyrus was there at one time. When this was placed on that papyrus document, before the seal was impressed on it, there was the fingerprint of the man who put it in place. And after he mashed his seal into it, the fingerprint, or at least a portion of it, still remained here. The ridges of this man's fingerprint are still there. This man is one who is known to us in the Bible. His name is Baruch, son of Neriah the scribe, a man who is very important, although barely mentioned, in the story of Jeremiah. Now, there's no doubt that these two seals both come, or two bulla, both come from the same original seal. The bottom one is in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. The top one is in the hands of a collector in London who has a lot of very interesting antiquities that a lot of scholars would love to get out of his hands. These are in two places widely separated, but there's no question that they come from the same original seal. And there's no question that the seal belongs to the man that we read about in Jeremiah chapter 32, verses 12 through 16, or at least not enough question to be of any merit whatsoever. This is a legitimate seal from the 7th century B.C., or a bulla, rather, bulla. Try and get the right term on the right artifact here. Well, when we look at the account in Jeremiah chapter 32, verses 12 through 16, this is the man who, when Jeremiah had signed the deed for the property that his cousin was selling to him in the middle of the siege of Jerusalem in 586 B.C., when Jeremiah had signed the deed, it was Baruch, the son of Neriah, who witnessed that deed and put his seal on it as well. Now, Baruch the scribe is an important man, as I said, in the story of Jeremiah. He turns up again in Jeremiah chapter 36, verses 3 through 32. That's the account of the Lord saying to Jeremiah, "Jeremiah, call Baruch the scribe and dictate to him all of the prophecies that I've given to you. And then take that and present it to the king." Or no, take it to the temple and read it. That's what it was. Baruch was to read it in the temple. So Baruch writes these things down, and they are presented in the temple. Some of the officials get alarmed, and they arrange to bring this into the presence of the king in such a way that Jeremiah will be safely secluded at the time when the king reads it. And as the scroll is read, column by column, every time a column has been read, and you can picture that because you've seen the Isaiah scroll up there, every time a column has been read, the king takes his knife and cuts that column off and throws it in the fire, because he has no intention of doing what Jeremiah has said. Baruch is the man who wrote that down at Jeremiah's dictation. When Jeremiah receives word that the king has burned up the scroll, he doesn't say, "Oh, well, we tried." Well, maybe he did say that. The Lord didn't say that. The Lord said, "Do it again. Write down everything you wrote down before, and I've got more to add." And so they wrote again. We come to the 45th chapter of Jeremiah, verses 1 and 2, and we have, in fact, a little bit further than verses 1 and 2. That's not quite adequate to cover the story of what the Lord had to say to Baruch, really the whole 45th chapter. The Lord had a message that was especially for Baruch, and I think it's a very interesting message, and I kind of puzzle over exactly what this message meant. The Lord gave Jeremiah a message for Baruch, son of Neriah, in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, king of Judah, after Baruch had written on a scroll the words Jeremiah was then dictating. So Baruch took the dictation for Jeremiah, and the Lord then gave Jeremiah a message for Baruch that is recorded in this place. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. "To you, Baruch, you said, 'Woe is me. The Lord has added sorrow to my pain. I am worn out with groaning and find no rest.'" Well, that tells me that Baruch did not much like being an associate of Jeremiah. Jeremiah is the weeping prophet, and if you hung around with him, bad things were going to happen to you. He learned that. He saw what had happened. He saw all the hostility, all of the official anger that was leveled against Jeremiah, and I think he wanted out. And the Lord said, "You can't get out. Don't do it. You stick with Jeremiah." Now, being a scribe meant being a professional. This man had a very sellable skill. And God says to him, "Don't start thinking about all the money that you could make. Say this to him," verse 4, "This is what the Lord says, 'I will overthrow what I have built and uproot what I have planted throughout the land. Should you then seek great things for yourself? Seek them not, for I will bring disaster on all people, declares the Lord. But wherever you go, I will let you escape with your life.'" Now, these two bulla are a connection in my mind with this man to whom the Lord gave this message. There is not only his seal, but also his fingerprint on this piece of clay that he stuck on a piece of paper when it was still wet 2,500 years ago. And the Lord's message for that man was, you stick with me. It won't make you a rich man, but you'll survive. You will survive. Now, I think that Baruch, in fact, did survive. When we go to the 43rd chapter of Jeremiah in verses 1 through 7, this is now after the city of Jerusalem has fallen, and the people are trying to figure out what they should do. And they go to Jeremiah and they say, Jeremiah, what should we do? Should we go to Egypt? Jeremiah says, you won't believe what I tell you. They said, yes, we will. Whatever you tell us, we'll do what you say. Jeremiah said, no, you won't. He said, yes, we will. So Jeremiah says, okay, this is what the Lord says. Do not go to Egypt. Stay in the land. Stay here. Obey the governor that the king has set over you. Everything will go well with you. And the people say to Jeremiah, you didn't get that from God. You got that from Baruch. Baruch told you to say that. Now, I don't know just why they thought that Baruch was the source of that information, but it's clear that there was a real partnership between these two men, despite the fact that his name is only mentioned in these four passages in the book of Jeremiah. Baruch, the son of Neriah, was a very important man in the work that Jeremiah was doing. So important that God gave a specific prophecy saying, don't abandon this work, stick with it, and I'll stick with you. Now, I think that becomes very important in the ultimate finishing of the book of Jeremiah and of the book of Kings and of the fact that there is a Bible for the captives to read in Babylon. I think that Baruch was instrumental in that, and there's Jewish tradition to go along with that idea, that Baruch was instrumental in making sure that there was a Bible for the captives in Babylon, that they would not forget the promises and prophecies of God. God had a special purpose in mind for Baruch, and that makes this little clay artifact one that is very impressive to me in particular because of the things that seem to be associated, without a lot of direct statements, with this man Baruch, who was so much a part of Jeremiah being able to do the work that God had called him to. And I was very glad in my brief visit to the Israel Museum, and we only were allowed about an hour to go through the Israel Museum, that I was able to find among the archaeology, the objects from archaeology there, both the silver scroll on display in the little glass place that you saw there, and also this bulla, the one that's on the bottom there, that had the imprint of the steel of the of this man Baruch, who was described for Jeremiah. And I was delighted to see both of those things. There were about six things that I really wanted to see in that museum in Jerusalem, in the Israel Museum. And just as I was running out of time, I caught the right place and happened to see the last three of those items, and this was one of those items. And it's a little bitty thing. I wanted you to have that impression from having that piece of Tootsie Roll in your hand and mashing it with your finger. It's a little bitty thing, but it ties in so beautifully with the account of Jeremiah's ministry and the work that God did with him, and is a bit of knowledge that has been preserved in our behalf, that we can have this confidence that in all the small details, as I have said before, in all the small details, the biblical accounts are trustworthy. This is not an exhaustive list. The list would go up past 20 now of the seals and bulla that have been identified within the last 10 seals and bulla that have been identified within the last 10 years or so of individuals named in the Bible where these remains have been found. You know, we don't have any documents that have the signature of Paul on them. And we don't exactly have any documents with the signature of Jeremiah on them either, but we do have the signature of the man who wrote down what Jeremiah dictated. And I think that's pretty neat. I'm really glad that we have a thing like that. Several other individuals, we mentioned Ahaz and Hoshea already. We also have a seal from Hezekiah. King Hezekiah had a seal that has been found in recent years. Baruch, I mentioned. Sariah is a man who is also the son of Neriah. He is mentioned in Jeremiah chapter 51 and verse 59. A bulla with the name of Sariah, son of Neriah, a servant of the king, has been found. And this is almost certainly the very army officer that Jeremiah gave a message to carry to the exiles in Babylon, there in Jeremiah chapter 51 and verse 59. Baalis was an Ammonite king, and a seal with his name has been found on it, the seal of Baalis, the king of Ammon. Baalis is mentioned for us in Jeremiah chapter 40 and verse 14, and he is mentioned in connection with Ishmael, not Ishmael the son of Abraham, but Ishmael the son of Nethaniah, who is mentioned for us in Jeremiah chapter 40, verses 8 and 14. These two men, Baalis and Ishmael, cooked up an assassination plot and carried out an assassination plot. Nebuchadnezzar had left a man named Gedaliah in charge of the people who remained in Jerusalem. And Ishmael was an army officer, and he reported to Gedaliah as though he were going to go along with the program, but he had already colluded with the Ammonite king Baalis to assassinate Gedaliah, which he did do. And the same man who found the silver scrolls also found a seal, or a bull, or rather, with the name of Ishmael on it, identified with this man. And it, like that one that I was pointing out to you of Baruch, had the fingerprint on it. And he took great delight in telling the story of finding the murderer's fingerprint on this piece of clay. And that if we could just find this man, we could definitely identify him positively as the man who did the deed, because we've got his fingerprint. We also have Bulla with the names of Hilkiah and Azariah, two of the high priests who are mentioned in the accounts in Chronicles. 1 Chronicles chapter 6, verse 13. And the list could go on. But the list isn't going to go on because our time is up. But when we can identify through these very small things biblical personages from the 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries B.C., and see that these people with these names had the jobs that the Bible describes them having, identifying real people with the biblical accounts, while that is only circumstantial corroboration for the Bible, and I use the word only in a kind of a ironic way here, it is very valuable and encouraging information, in my opinion, that what the Bible says about the small details is right on target. And as with the previous consideration that we've had, if you get the small stuff right, if you get things right in the places where you can check it, then that gives you a lot of confidence in the places where you can't check it. If it's right where you can apply a test, then we should believe that it's going to be right in the places where we cannot apply the test. I'm only going to point out a couple of things about this seal. That's two pictures, front and back, of this seal. It's cylindrical. It was made to be rolled. It had a hole running up through the middle because it was carried around on a cord. The seal has a standing man with some kind of a headdress. He has a staff in his hand, somewhat like the staff that was in the hand of that servant of Hosea that we saw in the previous scroll. It has a sun disk up here, a winged sun disk over the head of this man, and it has a three-letter Hebrew inscription on the back, which would be read Shlomo, which is another way of saying Solomon. Now, the man who owns this is the same man who owns that second Baruch bulla that was on the screen there, the green one that was in the upper corner. The same collector owns this as owns that bulla. And he thinks that this is from the 10th century B.C., which is to say from the time of Solomon. There's no way to identify this as being something that belonged to King Solomon or being something that belonged to someone associated with King Solomon, because there just isn't enough information. There just isn't enough evidence. It has the name, the Hebrew name Solomon, on it. It has figures on it that would indicate it belonged to a person of authority. But beyond that, you can't say much. And so this isn't a very good kind of evidence. It's not the kind of evidence that is really very interesting. It's a curiosity to look at an item like this. But when you can look at an item like the Baruch Bulla that specifically identifies the individual and his father's name and his job, that's a very strong kind of evidence. It isn't the sort of thing that you look at it and say, well, you know, maybe, could be, might possibly be associated with. It's the sort of thing that you can look at and say, yeah, this is very, very strong indication that we have here the signature of the man who copied down the dictation of Jeremiah and made sure there was a Bible for those people who were in exile in the land of Babylon. And I want you to remember, and by the way, if you still have your little bulla, you may either eat it or throw it away. If I told some people they would want clean hands for the class this afternoon, you may either eat or throw away that little Tootsie Roll that you squished as you see fit. If you still have one that's not been unwrapped and you don't want to consume that yourself, feel free to give that away. But by all means, this is not a tomb. This is not a repository. By all means, make sure these things do not end up on the floor, but rather either you consume or throw away all of the artifacts associated with the lesson that we had this afternoon. And thank you very much for sharing this time with me.